This is a Dreamcast disc and is for use only on a Dreamcast unit. Playing this disc on a hi-fi or other audio equipment can cause serious damage to its speakers.
Dreamcast, up to 6 billion players.
Welcome back to the stage of history.
Why don't we play together?
Hey, 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 it's time to make some crazy money. Are you ready? Here we go!
Please stop this disc now.
Right, hello and welcome to the Dreamcast Junkyard DreamPod episode 121. Now, if you are a new listener, you might be thinking, who the hell is this guy's voice? This is Kev. This is the first podcast I've actually been on since December 2021. That was the only episode I've ever appeared on that didn't have my intrepid sidekick slash co-host, Mike. How are you, Mike?
I'm good, Kev. Good to see you back on the podcast.
Yeah, it's good. It's good to be back. Moving house was a much bigger ordeal than I ever realised, despite how many people warned me. We are joined today by a very special guest. I would describe as a games journalist slash games author in Chris Scullion. How are you, Chris?
Yeah, I'm good. I'll happily take that. That's what I go with myself, so I'll go along with it.
Yeah, a question that I wanted to ask once I knew you were going to be on the show. How much of being a games journalist is fun stuff, like playing games, and how much is dealing with tedious online people being like, oh, why is it not running at 77 frames a second?
I'm glad you asked that because it shows that you care, because a lot of people make the assumption that when you tell people you're a games journalist, they say, oh, you just play games all day and it's a good laugh. It's like, no, it's so fucking so stressful. There are fun elements. To be honest, at VGC, which is where I work, it's just a 4-man team, so we're quite kind of got quite a short staff for the size of the site. So any kind of reviews and stuff we do when we play the games, it's actually out of office hours. So the actual 9 to 5 is writing the news and dealing with annoying people and avoiding death threats and the likes. But yeah, the actual game playing is out of office. So it's a lot. I'm not going to try and make it sound like it's brain surgery, but it's slightly tougher than people think.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's like I know Mike does a lot more of running the Twitter and the social channels for the Dreamcast Junkyard than I do, but I see the YouTube comments, and sometimes I wake up in the morning and it's the first thing I see, and I'm like, why are you this bothered about a video we put up six years ago? Like, me and Mike don't even know the person who made this video. Yeah. They're no longer on the team, but we have to deal with some of the I would say backlash, but it's undeserved backlash.
And the thing is as well, at least you guys are working on do a site that is focused on a single system, a single format, so that you would hope that at least most of the people coming to see your content likes the Dreamcast.
You would
dream, but when I do anything we do on VGC gets twisted, and so if I write a story about Sony doing something a bit daft, then you get all the people saying, oh, you're pro Xbox, and then when we write one about Xbox being a bit daft, suddenly we're Sony haters. So it's fun in games.
Yeah, I can imagine that. So one of the first questions I wanted to ask you is, what can you give us your background on games, and how did you get into games journalism?
Well, in terms of games, my dad had a Atari 2600 and a ZX Spectrum. So when I was born, basically, my dad says that when I was born, he put me in like a crib next to the TV while him and his pals played Football Manager on the Spectrum. So I was pretty much ingrained in games, whether I liked it or not. My aunt moved to America when I was really young, and when I visited her when I was like 4 years old, I saw the NES and Super Mario Brothers, and from that point on, I was like, games. So that's been it. And as I learned to read and stuff, my dad would always encourage my reading by buying me loads of games magazines like Mean Machines and Sega Power back in the day, and all that kind of stuff. Even like Mega, I absolutely loved Mega for the brief period it ran. It was only later on when I was like near the end of high school, I realized that, wait a minute, this is actually a job. There are people who actually, all these names I read in these magazines are actual people and this is their job. So this is maybe something I'd like to do. So I finished school, went to uni and did a journalism degree at uni with the kind of aim of being a games journalist. And then luckily enough, got in the official Nintendo magazine in 2006. And ever since then, I did ONM for 6 years, did a brief spell in Nintendo Gamer, did the last few years of CVG before it was shut down, went freelance for a bit, and now I'm at VGC. So it's pretty 17 years I've been doing it professionally, basically.
Yeah. I mean, impressed with that. The before your time, but I've still got all the like the tips, books, and guides that official Nintendo magazine would give away for the N64 stuff.
Yeah.
And when we were moving, my I'm going to describe her as my beleaguered better half. Was like, are you going to get rid of these? It was just like, I've kept them for 15 years through multiple different houses. What makes you think I'm getting rid of them now? Like, yeah. So I'm a big fan of, we don't talk about the other consoles as much on the Dreamcast Junkyard, but I know, Mike, did you ever have the N64?
Not at the time, no. I bought it 15 years ago when I was into retro gaming. But yeah, not at the time, no. I was strictly a PC gamer for that generation.
But it's like sometimes people are confused. Like, I remember at a trade show once when we had a stand, I was buying some N64 games and someone was a bit like, what are you buying that for? Yeah. It's like, we're not paid by the Dreamcast Junkyard. We do it as a hobby, but we do have... like a huge amount of other stuff.
Yeah. It's similar to me as well, because obviously my first gig was the official Nintendo magazine and I did it for so long. The vast majority of my kind of Twitter followers and stuff are Nintendo fans first and foremost. And I've got this reputation now as like the Nintendo guy, but that's just because, I mean, I love Nintendo obviously, but when I joined, there were no Sega magazines left. There was nothing like that. Like, I loved Sega as much as I loved Nintendo growing up. Like, I had my Master System. I got the Mega Drive Alter Beast, back in the day, like early adopter. So, like, I love Sega just as much. I just don't usually get as much of a chance to write about it and discuss it as I have done Nintendo over the years.
Yeah, and I feel like I've done a bad job here as co-host, but I didn't really mention one of the reasons we've got Chris on is because he's done a series of A to Z guides or looks at libraries for, and I've got all of these. I think Mike, you've got them all as well, haven't you? The NES, the SNES, Mega Drive / Genesis, and the N64. And in September, is it still on for September, Chris?
Mm-hmm. Yep, still on for September.
The Dreamcast variant of that is coming out. So that's one of the reasons why Chris is here with us today. Mike, you have got this pre-ordered as well, yeah?
I certainly have, yes.
So if you ever wanted a biased audience of podcast host, Chris, we are the people, because I know me and Mike are big fans of your work. I've actually given you an Amazon review, which I think I've only ever reviewed about 7 things. So it's like, that is praise indeed.
That's awesome. I appreciate that. I especially appreciate Mike's order, because I know Mike's got a similar book coming out soon. And I've had trouble with other people releasing books similar to mine's in the past, and it's nice for once to have someone who realizes that there's room for two books that handle the same subject from a different angle. And it's like, it's just nice to actually have people who are nice about it for once.
Yeah, I think I've got a large and very fulfilling Dreamcast library, which is starting to come up. I've got a few different Dreamcast books now. So yeah, the more Dreamcast books, the better for me. It's it's always good to see it.
Yeah, which is what I said to Chris. The Dreamcast community is not big enough for us to be getting tribal over. Oh, I'm only supporting the ROM books, or I'm only supporting Chris's books. It's like, I'm going to buy all the books. It's like, so
exactly.
So just the one of the questions then we've got for you then, what was your experience, or what are your thoughts on the Dreamcast then, Chris? Did you own one of these in contemporary time?
I loved my Dreamcast. Dreamcast was the first console I pre-ordered with my own like kind of money, because at that point I was finally getting like pocket money that I could save up for long enough to go, I need this Dreamcast, I'm going to save for long enough. So that was the first. I'd like to say I got it day one, but unfortunately I pre-ordered it through simplygames.com, and ordering buying stuff online in like the late 90s was nothing near as efficient as it is nowadays. So Simply Games like did a massive balls up of the Dreamcast pre-order, and basically if anyone who ordered through them didn't get their Dreamcast till like 2 or 3 weeks after launch, which was a bit of a nightmare. But they gave, to apologize for it, they gave you like 10 £20 off vouchers for Dreamcast games in the future, and this is when obviously games are £40. So the first 10 Dreamcast games I bought were only £20 because they messed that up, which is really nice. But yeah, I adore the Dreamcast. Obviously, I mean, I'm not telling you two anything you don't already know, but like it was for me, it was the first time arcade quality like was at home. And obviously there was a Neo Geo before it, but nobody had a Neo Geo because nobody had £12 million spare. But yeah, so the Dreamcast was for the first time for me, the very first instance of me going, this is as good as the arcades now. Like when I go, even though it slightly wasn't, we didn't know any different. Like when I'd go to arcades, I'd go, this version of WWF Royal Rumble is exactly the same as the one at home. They're both bad, but regardless.
Yeah, totally. That's very similar to us. I mean, I remember mine was the very last great Christmas present, is what I always ask. I was like 17, and I was in that stage where I didn't really know what to ask for, so I asked for that. And I remember having a go of it and being like, well, I'm 17 now, I know that this is just going to get wrapped up and left in the cupboard, can I just keep it out for the next month or so, because like, what's the point of it anyway? It's superb.
Yeah.
Right, so we spoke about the your other books. What can you can you describe for our audience then, or those listening, what process goes into to like coming up with the idea for moving on to a console, or how do you go from I've got this idea to what we get delivered and we flick through?
Well, it was only supposed to be one book. Like at the start, it was only like I'd back in the day, like when I used to read the Mean Machines and all that, my dad bought me a magazine once called The Complete Guide to Consoles, and it was made by the people who did CVG and Mean Machines, and it was basically a kind of double thick magazine that had it's claimed to be every game, but in hindsight it wasn't, but it was a lot of games at the time and like tiny reviews for each one, and I was obsessed with it. I was like, this is the greatest book that's ever, this is like a bible of games. And then when CVG, the site I was working on, shut down, and I went freelance for a couple of years, I thought I need to keep writing, and it'd be nice to do a book like that one, because that was my favourite thing I ever read about games. I thought it'd be nice to do a modern one of that, and it made sense to me to do the NES because that was the system I first fell in love with. So I tweeted, because I had no idea what to do, and I tweeted to anyone who's done a book before, how did you do it? did you have it written before you went to publishers or what? And I actually went to Dorling Kindersley, you know them that do all the kind of Marvel encyclopedias and stuff. I went to them first and pitched it, and it got as far as like a board meeting, and then they said, no, we kind of don't really get games. Like they basically didn't think a book about games anyone would give a shit, so that fell through. And by pure chance, John Wright, who's a guy, a publisher at a company called Pen and Sword, followed me on Twitter, and he says, I do books if you want to pitch it to me. So I did, and that's how the NES book started. And when it came out and started selling like reasonably well, he said, do you want to do more? I said, yeah. So basically every year or two, we do some more contracts and just keep it going. So it's basically after the Dreamcast book, there's another 6 or 7 coming. Nice. So far contracted and more to come after that. And the process for each book just differs depending on the console. The Dreamcast is... N64 and Dreamcast book, I'm doing Japanese games as well, just because the libraries are small enough. But I could go on forever, but I'm at risk of boring everyone. So
that's fascinating. I'm sure it is to Mike as well, especially hearing like the just tweeting out, has anyone wrote about
it? Pure luck.
Yeah, I love hearing about this type of stuff personally.
Yeah.
For anyone who's not familiar with the books or haven't seen them, I consider them a perfect companion to, especially like the, I've not got a NES anymore, but I'll do a lot of emulation. So just like looking through, and then there's like you said, it's every game, description of the game, nice screenshot. How long do you get to spend on each game then? So for example, I'm going to imagine you didn't get to complete Shenmue 1 and 2 fully again
I did not. it's weird. It's because, like, luckily, because they're more kind of reference books rather than review books. I know Mike's book is more kind of got like many reviews in each one. So that's one of the criticisms people give of my books is, why do you never tell me whether the game's any good or not? And it's like, well, like, again, like I say, we approach it in two different ways. Like, my way is just saying, like, this is a kind of reference style, like, encyclopedia thing. It's called an encyclopedia rather than a reviews guide. So I'll just tell you what the game's about, give you background on the story, and then if you like the look of it, you can go and decide for yourself whether it's good or not, because it's obviously subjective. So that's just my way of doing it. So it's an interesting one. Like I don't have to play the games all the way through, because I'm not, like, if I was reviewing them, then obviously I would try my best to do that, but then the book would take 10 years to write. Luckily with these, it's a case of just playing each game for an hour or two until I get a feel for it, and then I go to various resources, like the manuals. Like, I love that Sega Retro's got like every manual basically available, which is so helpful to get games plot and all that kind of stuff. And then I'll look through old magazines to get a kind of a feel for what the general vibe was on each game at the time. But to be honest, like, I picked these books because they're consoles I like, and I remember most of the games anyway. So I've already got a kind of base knowledge of like a percentage of the library. Most of the work is researching the games that I wasn't as familiar with, which in this case was the Japanese section mostly.
Mm. Yeah, totally. We mentioned this before we started recording, and fans of the show might be like, well, yeah, what the hell is this? But we did the top 200 vote. The vote was actually last year. We've only just finished the guide. And one of the reasons we've only finished the guide is because there's been so many, like, and I'm very grateful to these people, there's been so many fan translated from Japanese to English titles that people now vote for, because you could vote for 10 games. And so the most amount of work I've ever put into anything, and people will be like, well, it doesn't look like you put that much work in when they see it. 150 to 200. There was a load of Japanese games I've never even heard of. And I'd watch videos on them on YouTube and be like, I still have no idea what this game is about. Like, I don't know. Is anyone clicking here? Am I watching a cutscene? Is this a visual novel? Oh no, it's a puzzle game that's had a very long FMV. And it's true. Some of the Japanese games are absolutely bizarre.
That is like the book. Like, I write the books in the order that they appear, basically the order the games appear. So I start with the letter A and work my way through in the Western games, and then I start the Japanese games, the letter A, and work my way through. And I've kind of tweeted a couple of times, by the time you get to the end of the Japanese section, you can tell my mind has just gone. And like, so it starts like the ABC in the Japanese section is all kind of quite serious and like, this is this game. By the time it gets to the end, it's like, yes, it's another visual novel about schoolgirls, and it's just yep. You can tell I'm just getting angry by the end of it. Just like, it's a man just like losing his mind at trying to translate the weirdest things. So hopefully that makes it one of the more entertaining books that I've done, because I do like to throw like daffy jokes in there and like little sarcastic bits just to keep people interested. But yeah, by the end of the Japanese section, it was like, the amount of visual novels, geez, oh, it's hard going.
yeah, totally. I'm going to be honest, I've played very few of them. I normally defer to Mike if any of them ever would come up on any of the stuff we were on. Mike, just before we move on, just to draw you in, have you got a favourite visual novel that you would recommend anyone listening to this, listening to Chris, that fancies trying one, that's accessible?
Accessible as in a translation available, or accessible
translation, or like, yeah, you can play it via on screen, or the.
Yeah, so I mean, again, my Japanese pronunciation is going to be awful as usual, but the recently released Nakuro, the game offshoot of called Dame's an offshoot of now, but that's a good one. Obviously, Lewis was involved with that. That's a good one. In terms of actual visual novels, though, probably Ever 17. It's a really good one. I enjoyed that a lot. Also, you have, I'm trying to think what the ones are now. I spent a lot of time with sort of the earlier, a bit like what Chris said actually, the earlier ones I spent a lot more time with. By the time I got to like Y and Z and I started doing reviews of them, I sort of lost the will to live. So things like 2-1, I enjoyed quite a lot simply because I put a lot of time into it. When it gets to something like Yuki Guitar or whatever the name of the game is. That's, yeah, Lost for Will to Live then. So but there are lots of good ones out there. I just think you have to have a certain patience for the genre in the first place.
Yeah, all I can say is you both have my respect. Because by the time I got to what felt like the seventh Street Fighter title of the top 200 list, I think I just blithely wrote, I am not talking about another Street Fighter game, and then just moved on to the next game below. Moving on to a little question and answer section, Chris, was there any game you played for the book that surprised you that you would suggest others check out?
Yeah, I'd like to think that in terms of the Western kind of library, I knew like the majority of the games, but for some reason, Alien Front Online kind of passed me by like back in the day, probably because it was released so late. I really enjoyed playing through that when I came to doing the book. It's like, cause it feels so ahead of its time, a bit almost in the same way Headhunter feels like a kind of early. Almost like a GTA type, like a GTA 3 type thing. I think Alien Front feels like a kind of early version of the kind of online multiplayer games you still get nowadays. And even though the online is essentially dead without like having to go through all the kind of jumping through the hoops to get the online working again, the single player stuff was still really entertaining. I really enjoyed it more than I expected to.
Yeah, totally. Mike, have you played Alien Front Online? On the Dream Pi?
I have, yes. I've played it a few times.
Yeah, it's like just to echo what you said, Chris, that was what James Jarvis, who's our video guy, and he's kind of like one of our online experts. He got me online, like you say, jumping through those hoops, because I wasn't smart enough to figure them out. And when that came on, I just remember being like, holy shit, this game came out, this game came out 20 years ago. If they dumped that out now on like PSN or Xbox Live, I'm convinced those servers would be rammed with.
Oh yeah, and it's playable. Do you know what I mean? That's one of the great things about the Dreamcast is that so many of its games are still playable, like to this day. As in, obviously they're all playable, but as in like they hold up. A lot of when I did the NES book and stuff like that, I'm writing a Game Boy book just now. A lot of the games just don't hold up nowadays because the mechanics are so outdated that it's a real effort just to get through a level. Because there's so many of them are so clunky, but stuff like Alien Front Online and so many Dreamcast games, you could just upscale them and release them as digital titles today, and like they would do well.
This kind of ties into another question we're going to go to. If someone was coming new to the Dreamcast, is there anything that you don't think they would find on a kind of top 10, top 20 list that you would be like, look, do you know what? Check this out.
I was pleasantly surprised by Confidential Mission. Because that seems to get lost in the when everyone talks Virtua Cop, House of the Dead, Confidential Mission somehow doesn't seem to get mentioned that much. I think it's just as good. I like the kind of the cheesy kind of fake James Bond vibe to it. So that's like another one I would recommend it, especially because it's a light gun game. It's pretty easy to pick up and play. Like I'd like to say to people, oh, you should try. Something like Crazy Taxi, and even though Crazy Taxi is easy to pick up and play, like if you don't know the speed boost, you're probably going to get frustrated with it quite quickly. Whereas something like Confidential Mission, like it's pretty obvious what it is. It's a light gun shooter, and it's quite an entertaining me one. So yeah, that was another one that kind of
surprised me. Totally. Just as a little segue, either of you familiar with the National Video Games Museum that's here in Sheffield? Some people may have heard me mention this before, but I work in a school. We went on a trip to there just before we broke up, and they had Time Crisis. So I was with, 12, 14 to 15-year-olds who've never played a light gun game. And they were absolutely losing their mind. And they kept being like, because I work with kids who don't go to mainstream school. So they kept being like, Kev, holy fuck, have you played this gun game? And I kept being like, can't calm down. But yeah, it's freaking insane.
I think once I was going to sort of bit slightly off topic of that one, but in sort of similar vein, I was going to ask Chris, basically a lot of the games had quite a bad reception when the Dreamcast came out. I don't know about you, but I feel that they sort of shine nowadays. So a lot of the retro style games and things like Confidential Mission, which although it got, you know, a decent review at the time, I think because it was a light gun shooter and it wasn't that novel at the time, probably didn't stand out. I don't know if you have that same sort of experience when you replay.
No, I definitely agree. I mean, like you say, like it feels like you say, back then it felt similar to a lot of other stuff, but nowadays it feels fresh compared to a lot of the stuff you have nowadays. And also I think it's just nice to, one of the other reasons I do these books is almost as a detox from the stuff I have to cover, like in the during the 95, because I'm so done with microtransactions and season passes and games as a live service and stuff. And it's just really nice to play a game where it's like, here are the levels. Like, if you do well, you'll unlock something at the end. And like games like Confidential Mission that were considered maybe too basic back in the day are now considered, for me at least, like pleasingly basic. It's like it's nice to it doesn't mess about. It's just here's the game, enjoy it, and just kind of you don't have to faff about with anything.
Yeah, and like one thing we hear from a lot of our fans, especially as you get older in life and like jobs, careers, families, having to do stuff that you might not choose to do yourself, getting a disc out or a GDMU file, turning it on, playing the game, no patches, no downloads, like just today with the other Dreamcast members, I was moaning about, I've never used my PS4 controller wirelessly because I don't get to play on it often enough that it's ever charged. So it's just like some of the modern stuff, it feel a bit ungrateful moaning about it, but some of it just I could do without. I've only got 30 minutes, I want to use that constructively, not watching a download. Or like, I don't know if either of you have got the Series S, Series X, with a new dashboard update. It took me a shamefully long time to find where my games were kept because they put it in that little tiny tab at the top, haven't they? And it's just come on, lads. I had 12 minutes and you've taken four of them.
I couldn't find Game Pass for a week.
It's like...
couldn't find it.
It's just like, do you want to buy Shark Points, whatever they're called, for GTA? It's like, well, no, I've never even played that on this console. Why are you trying to sell me that? Anyway, I'm getting a bit old man shouting it. Progress. Mike, anything you want to ask before we move on to the next question?
No, I think I've covered my question.
Okay, so we did mention this, Chris. So have we done this four times now, Mike, or three times, the top 200 vote?
It's the fourth one.
But yeah, there is one, Chris, that we just don't mention because we seem to have lost the blog post for it. So technically we have done it four times now. So we recently ran the top 200 vote where listeners and us, we voted on our top 10 games. I've asked, if you were doing this, can you give us five that would make your top 10, Chris?
So it's basically about five.
Yeah, they can be in any order. So you don't know the way they ran. If you put a game first, it got the most points. If you put a game 10th, it got seeded. Shamefully, Spirit of Speed was tragically high as a result of...
That's disappointing.
Digital terrorism would be how I'd describe it, but.
Yeah, the numbers were cooked. I mean, obviously Shenmue goes without saying that that's kind of like one of the greatest games ever made, so I think Shenmue's a given. Crazy Taxi was probably the Dreamcast game I played most. I was obsessed with that. I'm not... Like I played it again for the book and I was like, here we go, let's do this. And I was like devastated at how bad I'd gotten, because it's like I had like when it first came out I developed like muscle memory of knowing where all the passengers were, where they were supposed to go, and like I had this map in my head. I could like play Crazy Taxi in arcade mode and make it run for almost an hour, like because I knew where everyone was going, and get like obscene scores. And nowadays, like when I tried it again, I was like, oh, I'm going to have to relearn all this. I couldn't be bothered. So that disappointed. It's still a fantastic game, but I'm disappointed I'm not as good at it as I used to be. What else? Soul Calibur still holds up, I think. It's still fantastic. Cannon Spike is my fourth one. It's another kind of massively underrated one I love. I'm always a sucker for crossovers. So the fact that Cannon Spike has got like Kami in it and Mega Man and stuff like that, I love that. It's just I really enjoy that game, and I know it kind of got odd kind of average reviews even when it came out, but again I think that's another one similar to what Mike says, that it's just aged well over the years, I think. And the last one, this is my favourite Dreamcast game, and it's such a bad game in a sense, but my favourite Dreamcast game is Dynamite Cop.
Nice.
Because it's just so mental, and I love The fact that it only takes like 15, 20 minutes, 30 minutes to beat it, I love that you can just turn it on every now and then, pick up a giant fish and hit somebody over the head with it. I adore Dynamite Cop and everything about it. So that's my fifth one.
Yeah, well, not enough games let you punch a crab in the face, do they? So it's like, yeah, that's a good shot. Mike, any that stand out to you there?
Dynamite Cop's a great shot, isn't it? I mean, I think, again, that probably goes back to the fact that you look at Dreamcast anew, I think games like that stand out because you don't get those kind of games nowadays, do you? Or if they are, they're sort of deep in the store and no one really notices them on consoles. So, yeah, Dynamite Cop's just, you know, one of my favourites as well. But I suppose, Chris, any of the ones you would pick? Have any of them sort of, would any be in your top 10 games overall of any console, for any platform?
It's a weird one. I mean, like, probably if any of them would, then Shenmue would. Just because it's weird. Shenmue is like a kind of the Beatles of video games, where if you gave it to a kid nowadays, they'd be like, I don't see what the big deal is. And it's like, because they didn't live it, they didn't see like how it changed everything. And the fact that probably if a kid was to play Shenmue today, I would imagine most of them think this just plays like everything else. And it's like, well, that's because it was the first to do it. And it's similar to the Beatles. When you listen to the Beatles music, I think a lot of kind of kids go, yeah, it's good, but like, it's just music. And it's like, yeah, but that's because the Beatles like were the first to do that, and then everyone else copied them. So the Shenmue would definitely, I think, of the five there. I know Dynamite Cop, I said, is my favourite, but and like putting my serious hat on and not just, I like this game because you can punch down a Marilyn Monroe like statue and beat somebody over the head with it. Shenmue is probably the one that would end up in an all-time top 10, I would think.
Yeah.
Just a question that I'm throwing in here. We've got a Shenmue 1 and 2 podcast that we've been planning for about 3 years now, because that's how long it's taken me to complete the second one. What are your thoughts on Shenmue 2?
Do you know what? I didn't finish that one. Like, at that point, that was when I played that on Xbox, because at that point I got that one on Xbox. And I started uni at that point, and at that point I just didn't have time. So I started Shenmue 2. Got about halfway into it and never got around to finishing it. I enjoyed it. I think it's one of those ones where it was never going to have the same impact as the first game did, because the first game was so revolutionary and the second game felt a bit like more of the same. I remember enjoying it. I will get around to finishing it one day. I bought the HD version. So, and I still haven't played 3 because I insist on finishing 2 first.
Well, so, I feel like we're the same person living in different timelines. I've only just finished 2, having started it multiple times, and I keep promising Lewis I'm gonna play it and we're gonna talk about it because it's one of his favorite games. And then it's just like, you would be surprised how popular your answer is of I played it. And if Tom was here, our founding father, I know he'd already be ranting about carrying those crates because like so many people, it was just, well, I've gone from racing forklifts to having to carry crates in a fashion that makes no sense.
Shenmue 2 is weird, isn't it? Because it's probably, no one can really dispute, it's a better game. As an actual game, it's better than the first one. However, the first one has just got this emotional resonance, which I don't think any other games had since. It's weird.
Yeah, and once you move to the what I'm going to refer to as the second area, and it's a bit smaller, it becomes a bit more streamlined. That's where I found it a bit more enjoyable, which is probably something we'll talk about on that. Lewis is going to edit all of this out. He'll be like, Kev, you bastard. I've waited years on you so we could do this. Now you're doing it with Mike and Chris. Right.
Also, the first one just had that set kind of weird kind of homely feel about it, because you were exploring Ryo's like hometown. So it's like you're new to this place, but he's not. And it's like you're learning who everyone is through him, and to him, oh, there's a news agent, there's a guy who, the man with the questionable accent, who works at the van, there's all this and that. And you go, oh, this is cool. This guy knows this place, this isn't a strange place, this is home for him, and you're getting to see him in his home life. And the second one, is as much as I love it, it's him in a in a environment that's unfamiliar to him, and so many games are about being in an unfamiliar environment, and so in that way I think it loses a bit of its kind of spark as well, because I think the first one just has that nice kind of homey feel about it, as if you're in the kind of listening in on this guy's day-to-day life.
Yeah, just the last thing I'll put on here before we move on. Do you know the ending of Shenmue when it's the cutscene where he walks down from his house, like down through all the areas, and he goes through through the height, goes past the arcade, and he gets on the bus, and it's like you see all the people that you've spent like hours interacting with, and you know those players. I just think that is such a powerful, brilliant end to a game, because it's not the end of the game or the end of the story, but it's the end of that kind of that chapter. And I just feel like even though it was like 1/10 of the story they wanted to tell, they probably maybe would have been better just leaving it there.
Because at the risk of sounding pretentious, when you started the game, it was his home, and when you finished the game, it was your home.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. I like that. That's going to be the segment we're going to cut out. Not me saying they should end it there, because Shenmue Dojo will unfollow us on all the channels. Right, I can't segue this, so I'm just going to read the question like it's off a PowerPoint. As a football fan, how do you rate the titles available on the system?
Well, obviously Shenmue. football's a funny one. I'm a massive fan of football video games. I will play literally any football video game, like no matter how good or bad. So probably when I was doing the book, I spent most time on the football games just because I just forgot to stop playing them. So I'd spent longer than I probably should have playing, like 90 minutes, especially because that was right at the start of the book. I was like, I should probably get a move on here. Stuff like UEFA Dream Soccer and UEFA Striker and stuff, they were all okay. But I know Virtua Striker is like a Marmite game, but I'm very much on the side of loving Virtua Striker. I know a lot of people do, but I think if you treat it as an arcade game and not as a football game, I think it's fantastic. So... yeah, of all the football games on the Dreamcast, I think Virtua Strikers 2 is my favourite, just because it's weird. As a football game, it's awful.
Yeah.
You can't dribble for more than 2 minutes, two seconds before someone just scythes you down and takes the ball off you. But once you learn the kind of passing and learn that it's actually easier to score from 40 yards out than it is from 4 yards, and you can score some of the most ridiculous goals of all time in it, it's pure arcade joy. So yeah, Virtua Striker is my pick, but I fully appreciate that a lot of people would strongly disagree with that.
What did you? I will, because this involves you, Kev. So I'll go. What was your opinions on Giant Killers? I know Kev is a massive Football Manager fan, as am I, and he's got a series of videos currently going out for it as well. But I mean, what did you think about that? Obviously, it's a playing a 20-year-old management game is odd at the best times.
It was a weird one, wasn't it? I just couldn't click with it. But I think again, that's because it is clearly one of those games that requires a lot of time to kind of. Well, obviously, just to even just play a season, and I didn't have that kind of time commitment. So for me, I like the fact that it exists, because I love the idea of Americans trying to complete their Dreamcast collection and ticking off the few Europe only ones and getting Giant Killers and turning it on and going, "What in the hell is this?" Yeah. So I love that idea, and obviously, it's like. I think it's the in terms of file size, it's by far the smallest Dreamcast game, understandably. It's an interesting one. It's not the sort of thing I would find myself playing a lot. I've never really been into it. The odd occasion I've been like got hooked on a football management game is like I've become too hooked on it, so I tend to just stay away from them and to do the ones where you actually play instead of managing.
I feel like I'm being shamed here, Mike.
No, at all. Listen, when I was at uni, I lived with three guys who played Football Manager non-stop in their respective rooms, so I felt the loneliness of living with three people who never left the room because all they did was play Football Manager.
No, but Mike, we love Virtual Striker. What
we do.
What year was the Play Blackpool event? I always forget this. Was it 17, 18?
2018, yeah, 2018.
So 2018, we had like roughly 20 Dreamcasts set up in Blackpool, Chris. And a random guy comes up with his kid, who was probably about 14, 15, And he's like, oh, guys, he's like, I had a Dreamcast. He's like, I had this football game that wasn't really good to play, but we're like Virtual Striker. So go around the back of the table and we've got it on two consoles. And it was just like, I could just see him there playing it with his kid and his kid just not getting it at all.
I love that. That's a perfect description. It's a football game that's not very good, but I love it.
And I always explain it to people when they're like, oh, how do you get good at this? I'm like, have you ever seen rugby league? And they're like, no, but it's a football. I'm like, yeah, but do you know how in rugby league they have to kick the ball away to get further away from their own goal? That's what you need to be doing. You need to be kicking it out for a throw and then tackling the other person in their half. Like,
that is the best tactic. Just get rid of it as soon as you get it. Yeah. Get rid of the ball.
Yeah, no, but yeah, we like I said, we're big fans of that. That was in my own top 10 games. Me and my friends, we absolutely loved that. We used to play the heck out of the arcade machine. And then when it came home, we'd always be playing that. And other people would have a go. And they'd always be like, this isn't any good. Why are you lot so obsessed with this game? And just be like, oh, no, I don't know. We just are. Like, there isn't a reason for... It's like asking me why I have brown hair. I can't really give you an answer. Yeah, so they're not great. Are there any other sports games that you did enjoy? I know I've gone off script again, but...
Like Virtua Tennis was the obvious kind of the big one. Virtua Tennis was the game that bonded with my uni flatmates over, because like, when I started uni, the uni just put us in to random flats with like four random guys. Although the PS2 was out and I brought my PS2 with me to uni so I could play DVDs and stuff, I thought I'm going to bring my Dreamcast and put it in the living room, because that's going to be a way to get us all to kind of... Because I had four controller ports, basically. I was like, there's four guys, four controllers, this will work. And it did. The Virtua Tennis was the game we all kind of like grew together, like playing, to the point that we kind of invented our own version of it called Danger Tennis, where basically we'd come home from the pub, and I would always do best because I don't drink, so they would all come home drunk and I'd come home sober as a judge, and we would just play Virtua Tennis like all through the night. And it was called Danger Tennis because obviously it was doubles. We would play it in at totally random moments, like one of us would fall asleep, so the other one, you not only had to play, make sure you were playing the game, you also had to keep an eye on your partner and make sure that he was, your doubles partner was still awake, so you obviously had to get a sharp jab in the ribs to make sure that he's going to get the ball when it comes to him, stuff. So that was the danger element, it was the jab in the ribs if you fell asleep. But yeah, Virtua Tennis was the glory days. I suppose the Tony Hawk games, if they count as sports.
We allowing that, Mike? I'm allowing that.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And I suppose we're counting wrestling as a sport, I would imagine.
Yeah, so that leads into the next question, the wrestling game. So,
oh yeah, Dreamcast was weird for wrestling games, wasn't it?
Yeah, because you've mentioned at the start the Royal Rumble.
Royal Rumble game.
I was like, and I get that as a 41-year-old man, I should let this go, but I spent £45 of my own money as a 17-year-old on that game, and I don't hate anything in life as much as I hate that memory of how disappointing. Like, this was when I was like peak, like, was it still WWF then? Or
yeah,
like,
it was at that point.
Yeah, it was like, I was like 17 and could stay up and watch the pay-per-views and like stay up all night and like it not be a problem, could go into school, go into work the next day. And that game was just atrocious. And a few people before have called me out, like, oh, do you need to give it another chance? It's like, no, I don't.
definitely don't. Like, I was arguing about it with somebody recently because somebody was talking to me about the book, and they said, oh, obviously you'll have Royal Rumble in there. I was like, yeah, Royal Rumble's in there. So I loved that game. I was like, did you really? He says, yeah. I mean, it's like, it's still got the record for the most wrestlers on screen at any time. I was like, yeah, I know. Because it had up to nine wrestlers in the ring at any one time. And I says to him, why do you think nobody's bothered to do that again? Because it's unplayable beyond belief to have nine wrestlers in a ring and to not be able to accurately choose who you're aiming at. It's an absolute mess of a game. But I mean, like, not that there was a lot of other options. Like, you had WWF Attitude, which was really clunky. Like, it was fine back then, but nowadays it's just because you have to remember all the button commands just to do like normal body slams. And then they did the two ECW games based on the same engine. They were even worse. Obviously, all the best ones were in Japan. Like, Fire Pro Wrestling D is, like, I think, the best wrestling game on Dreamcast. But yeah, it was, especially when at the time N64 had like No Mercy and stuff like that, and PlayStation did the SmackDown games. It was like, that was the one area I think where Dreamcast felt slightly lacking, I think.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I'm doing the same thing to you, Mike, that I always do. That I, hey, what are the Japanese? Is it Giant Gram, the other one?
Yeah.
The other,
yeah. Giant Gram and Giant Gram 2000, was it?
Did you have much experience with these, Chris? What were they like?
Yeah, I like those. I mean, I didn't, at that point in the book, I was like trying to fire through it because yeah. I'm really bad at like leaving things to the last minute. I was like, I need to finish this book. I'm going to kind of go back through them because those are, I made a checklist of games that I want to go back and properly play once the book was done because I really enjoyed them, and the Giant Grand ones were those because they feel like good representations of Japanese wrestling, and that they're slower and more more methodical and more kind of tactical, a lot more about kind of striking rather than grappling, if you'll forgive me for getting a bit nerdy. I'd like to go back and play those in the All Japan Pro Wrestling game as well, to give those a go, and spend a bit longer on them. But I really enjoyed what I played of them.
Yeah, probably news to no one watching this, but for something else I was writing for the site recently, I discovered they've got Jeffrey, and I can never know how his name's pronounced. Is it Kaje, the ninja from Virtual? They are.
Yeah, that's a weird one, isn't it?
They're playable characters in Giant Grab, and I was just thinking like holy crap, this looks like the type of thing I would have been into at the time. Like, but I'm not sure.
It's a good game. It's worth checking out. It's a very different kind of feel of a wrestling game. It feels like the sort of thing that's going to take a while to kind of get used to. But I liked what I saw of it.
Yeah, totally. So Mike, I've got an official question lined up, but do you have anything you just want to add in or ask Chris on the back of that?
I'm going to ask a random question. I'm going to ask a random question. What is the weirdest game? And I'm talking about Japanese exclusives here, because obviously, let's face it, they are. What is the weirdest game you had to play during the writing of the book?
The weirdest one? Let me think. What I'm going to do now, because my mind is a mush, I'm going to cheat and bring up my list of games so that I can see off the top of my head. It's funnily enough, one of the weirdest ones was a Western release, which was The Ring, Terror's Realm, because as someone who's a massive fan of The Ring movies... it's such a really weird take on The Ring, and it was like what's actually going on here. So that was a really weird one. I'm just looking at my list here. I don't know if these really count as games, but to try and kind of, for the sake of completion in the book, I covered the kind of non-games that were released in Japan as well, and that was it something kawaii, what was it? The one they released for the magazine. Extra Kawaii. I've somehow managed to get hold of like a GDI file for that, because obviously I'm not paying like obscene money just for the sake of a small entry in a book. That's one area where me and you differ, is that you have enormously dedicated to doing the collection, which I
actually bought Extra Kawaii about 5 weeks ago for £20 because no one.
Are you joking?
No, I am. Yeah, it's amazing. That's unbelievable. Someone was on there. It was on there for like £200, bastard. And it didn't sell. Like, they relisted it for £20. I was like, all right, I'll grab that one then.
That's unbelievable. I was looking at it a bit. I was like, no, I can't. The rare times I'd seen it, I was like that. I can't remember how much they were selling it for, but it was like a lot.
Yeah,
I thought I can't do that. But yeah, that's devastating. I would have definitely bought that. But yeah, so that was one of them, just because it's that weird. I can't remember the name of it, but the kind of fashion style where they deliberately give themselves like orange faces because it's like they look tanned, so it's like a really odd kind of. Magazine anyway, but then the Dreamcast game is like a digital version of that magazine with interviews and stuff, so that is like a weird one, just because just generally the idea of a Dreamcast game based on a girls magazine I thought was quite funny. But yeah, there's a lot of kind of weird stuff on there, but I enjoyed the weird ones. It was that's half the fun, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Just to follow up that, do you feel like the Dreamcast has got up more of a kind of strange? I was going to say like entries in the library. The example I'm going to give is I'm not sure if you have seen this. Tom did an article on, and you might have to correct me on what the name of this is, Mike, but it was like a Toyota Celica disc that they gave to car showrooms to play in a Dreamcast.
That's it.
And I just like, even though I had come to the Dreamcast staff partly through reading Tom's articles and being fascinated by them, I remember reading that and thinking like, who signed off on this? Like, what was the audience for this?
I love that idea, though. I love the idea of going to like a Toyota showroom and saying, I'd quite like to test drive that one. And they say, no need, take this home. and look at a kind of basically rendered version of it.
Yeah, it's like, rather than driving it, do you have a Dreamcast? Oh, yeah. Luckily, I bought that for my housewife with the housewife's bundle with the keyboard.
Put so those car keys away. I love stuff like that, and stuff like the horse racing ones, the GRAPAT for Dreamcast, like the ones that you would use to bet on horses online and stuff like that, which are obviously just like coasters now, the discs, but like just the idea that they exist, I love that. So I tried to get as many of those in the book as possible, just to kind of make it as definitive, even though I know for a fact that I'm going to get people complaining that those don't count. But yeah, we'll see.
Let them complain. It sounds glorious to me. So, just a question I've added in: are there any notes or anything you make about games that don't make it in the book? Like stuff that you might make as references or that as you go along, or do you have like a writing key or anything like that? Or
I mean, to be honest, usually when I'm playing at first, I've got my phone with me, and I'll take the odd notes that I'll think of while I'm playing. Just anything that strikes me as unusual while I'm playing. Like usually when it's the visual novels, I'll just write dodgy as hell. But often the notes that I take when I get to the research stage is like the stuff I find in the research is more interesting than the notes I've taken, and usually what I've written gets kind of put to the wayside in favour of the more interesting stuff. The most difficult part, but I think the part most people talk about in the books, is the facts that I do for each game. I don't know why I came up with the idea of doing that, but basically every single entry has its own fact, and sometimes they're related to the game, sometimes it's related to the subject the game's about. If it's a movie tie-in, it might be a fact about the movie or something, and those can sometimes be the trickiest, especially the Japanese section of the Dreamcast book, because so many of these games a lot of people don't really know anything about in the first place, without then having to say, oh, and here's a fun fact about it. It's like, man, I don't even know what it is. So that was easily the most difficult bit, but I managed it. So, but some of those facts in the Japanese section are going to be quite, tenuous.
I don't know. I'm glad they're there, because I love those facts personally.
Oh, good. Excellent. So. Yeah. I think it's the one thing I do that makes the book stand out. I think for, especially the fact that multiple people are doing multiple books like these nowadays, I think we all need kind of some, because obviously your main standout with your book is that you cover every single version of every single game and have all the box art and that, which is like obscenely brilliant. That's like, I couldn't even begin to do that. So I'd lean more on the kind of the weird, quirky, fun fact side of things, which I think is good, because it makes both our books, like, although they're about the same subject, they both will have a really completely different kind of feel to them. So I would strongly advise everyone buys both of them.
Very much. Yes.
That's what we're going to put out on social.
Buy all the books, please.
Buy all the books, please. Yeah. Right. So a little question I've got here then. So, and we've kind of touched on some of this before, but if you were getting someone to try the Dreamcast for the first time, what titles would you have them play? So, and you could think of this as if you'd been brought in to advise on like a Dreamcast Mini, imagine it that way. What would you suggest goes on that? Or,
Jimmy White to Cue Ball. No, I'm only joking.
Don't worry. It's got great music, though.
It does, but that's about it. I quite like Jimmy White's too, but it definitely wouldn't be the first thing I'd recommend. Probably the more kind of the action-y ones, so like Soul Calibur or even like Ready to Rumble, because it's a bit daft, even though I think some of the characters in it are a bit questionable these days. Mm-hmm. But I would maybe recommend Ready to Rumble. The basic stuff like Virtua Tennis, the stuff that has the more kind of arcadey feel to it. Because obviously the whole point of arcade games is that they should be easy to pick up and play. And those are the ones that are more immediately accessible to people who are new to the system. I think they're the ones that have aged better as well. Like I say, stuff like Shenmue, I would hope that anyone new to the Dreamcast would try out Shenmue and fall in love with it anyway. But obviously some people are... I was going to say ignorant, but that sounds really harsh. But some people maybe wouldn't appreciate... the impact it's had and would judge it by today's standards and might think it's maybe a wee bit clunkier than like a Yakuza or something. So I wouldn't maybe start them with that. I would start them with stuff that's that holds up a bit better today and then slip Shenmue in. Like that sounds really dodgy. But I'd follow up with Shenmue and say, like, right, you're in now try this.
Yeah, it's got better darts than Jimmy White, at least. So
it does, and it's got better racing in the arcade games. It's got better racing than Spirit Speed.
Yes, it has. Did you manage to play Spirit Speed for this book? Or are you still waiting on it loading?
Well, so. play is a strong word. I managed to make the car go and tried to, and almost got it around the track. It's a piece of work, isn't it?
We are going to be in so much trouble.
I'm contractually obliged by James to say that the game is misunderstood, but we all know that's wrong. So, I mean,
misunderstood.
It's terrible.
It's misunderstood in that the developers didn't understand that they had to make a racing game.
Yeah.
Well, if you are the person who, just to get another book plug in here, if you think, do you know what, I would like to learn more about this Spirit of Speed game, you can read James's 10-page written excerpt on it, which is fantastically produced.
It's great. Yeah, it's great.
It has got that old magazine feel to it, but that is in the Dreamcast year too, that you also find myself and Mike throughout. So,
yeah.
moving swiftly on. It's like the podcast. So this is a very self-centered question from myself, Chris. But
okay.
And I did put this in the notes that sent across to you. But one of the first times I came across your work is someone shared your Kart Racers series with me on your Tidal Tack blog.
Yeah.
What do you think of the kart racers on the Dreamcast? Because I'm gonna preface this. Me and Mike are fans, so be very careful with any criticism.
No. To be fair, I don't have a lot of criticism. Like I think the Dreamcast is a fairly strong karting library for a system with a library that small. I think there's some good choices. I think Looney Tunes Space Race is like a hidden gem. I think that's a really solidly done karting game. I think, obviously, if you count Star Wars Episode One Racer, but I'm not sure if you do, it technically is a bit, because it's got like multiple characters and stuff in it.
Mm-hmm.
Wacky Races is good. Even South Park Rally I quite like, even though it's a bit weird. The only one I'm iffy about, and not because of the game itself, but just because of the premise, is the Walt Disney World Quest Magical Racing Tour one, because I can't believe... They made a Disney game and then like most of the characters are completely fictional. It's like, what are you doing? It's like, I bought this.
Why is there no Mickey Mouse? Yeah, why, exactly. the biggest like, waste of a license.
It's like Chip, okay, Dale, okay, then just some made up dog thing. Yeah, yeah. What are you talking about?
It does have, and you did the NES book, it does have the feel of like a NES game that with a week to go that they've changed. It's Disney now. Why? Because I've told you it is. Like, just get,
take those two out and put Chip and Dale in. We don't have time for the rest.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's quite bizarre, isn't it? When you mentioned Looney Tunes Space Race, have you played the mode of that where you unlock and you can put the anvils on?
No, I didn't.
What are the other objects that fall, Mike? Anvils, pianos,
TNT or ACME things. I don't know. It was so nerve-wracking. I've forgotten what was dropping from the sky. Pink elephants?
Pink elephants, yeah. I can't remember if it's called chaos mode or if my mind has just filled that in, because as well as trying to race with all the kind of craziness that is in, it starts throwing all these Acme power-ups at you, like, what, every 3 seconds, two seconds?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
That's awesome. Is that awesome or is it annoying? It's a bit of both.
It is a bit of both. It is far less annoying than the blue shell. I will give it credit for that in Mario Kart. But it is one of those bizarre modes that, like, it's worth experiencing just to be like, this was made by someone who potentially hates gamers.
It's one that's on my list to play more. I'm going to bring that series back. Basically, for those who don't know it, which is most people. The series was called Cartography, which I thought was a really clever pun, but then in hindsight it probably wasn't. And it was meant to be like mapping the history of karting games one game at a time. But I would do like a really deep dive in each game. So it would be like, here's every single character, every single track, every single weapon. And then give them all ratings in each category out of 10. And then each game would have a final score and it would go on a leaderboard and stuff. And Looney Tunes Space Race is one. I want to bring that back, and I want to do Looney Tunes Space Race because I want to spend more time with it and properly unlock everything and like find that mode that you're talking about. I half wrote a South Park Rally one. Before I joined VGC, and then kind of all my title hack free time disappeared. But I'm now in the process of getting that free time back. So that'll be one that I definitely bring back, and Looney Tunes is near the top of that list.
No, yeah, I'm just a fanboy bit here. If anyone's into kart races or if that sounds up the street, I would go check them out, because prior to deactivating my original Twitter, I was always just hassling on you. Have you played Luigi? Have you played Chris? Did you know that Sumo Digital were involved in the Disney Infinity kart racing? Wait, maybe you could like.
That's fantastic. That Disney Infinity. That's one I desperately wanted to do, but like, because I do the deep dive and do every character, that would be impossible because of how many characters are in Disney Infinity. But that's a fantastic kart racing game that nobody knows about. Because you had to have Disney Infinity and have stuck around until the end of it to have bought it.
So tragically, if you go on our Xbox profile, and it is the combination of me and my six-year-old daughter, if you go to the stats for Disney Infinity, where it tells you total playtime, I think we're on about 29 days. And the next nearest person is about 5 hours. And I'm like, oh, well, that's their problem. They should have.
Yeah, it's a fantastic game.
Yeah, they should have realised what a superb sandbox, especially if you've got young kids, because she's graduated from like being able to just walk around on an empty world to like throwing in enemies to building tracks. It's like I could make my own podcast about how much we love that. I feel like
that's one of our proudest accomplishments, is that my kind of games room has got like every Disney Infinity figure and every Lego Dimensions figure. It's two massively underrated games.
Yeah, totally.
I know that there's a lot of kind of bad things said about Toys to Life, and I've never been into Skylanders and like that, but when it's toys that I actually cared about collecting anyway, like Disney figures and Lego figures, I was all for it. I think both those games are fantastic.
Yep, totally. Right, so we just got Mike. What is your favorite kart racer? I don't know if I've ever asked you that. Wacky Races, yeah. I was surprised by how great the hub, the hubs. I know it's not quite
great.
Diddy Kong racing, but like the little like getting to little like razz around in the car and like
it's a commentator for me. It's the entire. I loved Wacky Races as a kid, so that game is one of the greatest cartoon adaptions from that era. It's amazing. I like all of them. I think they're all pretty good. South Park Valley is a little bit annoying, but I never liked South Park. But Looney Tunes, it looks just amazing still. I mean, that pre-rendered and mix of pre-rendered and not, it's just amazing. And I actually do enjoy Magical Ball Quest as well, simply because of the fact that I like listening to the Pirates of the Caribbean theme tune over and over again.
That's a good show, actually, to be fair.
I do
that game for its racing. For me, half the fun of a kart racing game is characters that you know. Which is why like the game I probably spend most time on just now is that Disney Speedstorm, kind of free-to-play one that's out just now. So embarrassingly, I've put like 60, 70 hours into that. And just because I know all the characters, and that's like half the fun for me. So, yeah, I do like Walt Disney World Quest, but just, yeah, it rubs me up the wrong way that technically I'll only ever play as Chip or Dale.
I think the weird thing is with it as well is that the game is, the license is actually the park, isn't it? And that's the problem. And it's sort of, it's sold so badly because Walt Disney is this massive sort of license, and then they license the park, which just seems to me like a bit of a weird mix. It's a little bit like playing the Disney, I think it's what the actual name of the game is on 360 a few years ago now. It was a Kinect game originally. I enjoyed that.
That Kinect Rush, was it a Disney Rush or something? Pixar Rush?
It's the one which you actually go around the parks, not the kart racing game.
Disneyland.
I know the one. It's on Games
Adventures,
Pass,
Disneyland Adventures.
That's it. Yeah, I mean that was great because you sort of went around the park. It also had the characters and sort of the levels based on the characters. But Magical World Quest is a decent game. It's just it's such a lack, such a waste of potential.
Yeah, such a weird use of a license.
Yeah,
and I probably asked you this before. What's the Flintstones game? Is this playable in any form, Mike, or did we just get screens for that?
No, so the beta was released, so that was released years and years ago. What's the name of the film based on?
Is it Viva?
Viva Rock Vegas?
Yeah, have you had a chance to dabble with this at all, Chris? You'll get no judgment from me if you say no, because judging from what I've just explained, Mike, is it out?
Yeah, no, I haven't yet because it wasn't officially released. I've got like a wee folder with all these betas and stuff that I've work through when I have a bit of time, but I never put them in the book. Same with and this is the bit that's going to get me the most shit for the book, is that I've not put any indie games in it. And I appreciate that indie games are such a big part of the Dreamcast library these days, but I've basically just put a bit in the book saying, by the way, people are still making Dreamcast games, so keep an eye out. The book's supposed to just be like the games that came out during the Dreamcast life, in an attempt to kind of make it a definitive book, because if I started doing indie games, it would be out of date already, because I finished writing it like last year. So it would already be out of date by the time it came out. So it's a shame because I love the kind of indie scene. Even though I've not had much time to dabble with it, I love the fact that people are still making Dreamcast games, and some of them look like really good. It's just that for completion's sake, I decided just to focus on the kind of official retail stuff.
No, I totally get that. I was like, I have the NES book, and I was a huge NES fan in the era, but I'm real casual with it now. If you'd filled that full of, I don't know, 100 indie games that had come out, I'm going to be honest, I'm never going to play them, worse still, I might pirate them. So you could say it's as anti-piracy move, I'm not listing the indies. Go and find out about them yourself.
You're welcome, indie developers.
There we are. this is the clip that we are going to put on.
You're welcome. You're welcome for not covering your games.
Yeah. When you put it like that, maybe not. You mentioned Star Wars Podracer. A question I'm going to throw in: are you a Star Wars fan, first, Chris, or do you like Star Wars games?
Yeah, I like Star Wars.
Star Wars Episode 1 Podracer. Have I got that right? It's got a very strange title, isn't it?
Episode 1 Racer, but the colon's
Episode
in a really
1
weird,
Racer.
The colon's in a weird place where it shouldn't be. I can't remember. I think it's Star Wars Episode 1 colon Racer. It just annoyed me that's why I got really pedantic about grammar, and it annoys me when I write about that one.
Yeah, I did what we did. I'm not sure if you were on the episode, Mike, but we did like a whole 1 hour video special on that, and I still don't know what it's called despite really liking it. Where would you rate that? It's obviously the Dreamcast best Star Wars game, I would say, because it's got very, very little competition. Although Jedi Power Battles is very fondly remembered by people of a certain age, we have discovered. But where would you rank that in amongst the kart races, if you were putting it, or other Star Wars games?
If it counts as a kart racer, I would have it reasonably high. I quite enjoyed that. Once I realised there was a speed boost, like even back in the day when I had it, because I had it, it was one of the Dreamcast games I had. Like I bought it when it came out, and bizarrely, for it was one of those few games I didn't actually look at the manual because I thought it was a racing game in it, and it took me an embarrassingly long time to realise there was a speed boost when you hold up. I was like, why am I so bad at this game? It's like, that's why. But in terms of where it sits in terms of Star Wars games, I think at the time it was one of the best. Like nowadays it still holds up, but obviously you've got the Lego Star Wars games and stuff like EA's Star Wars games kind of have overtaken it a bit, obviously, in terms of like everything. But as someone who likes racing games and who likes Star Wars, it's one I'll always have a wee kind of soft spot for. It's certainly better than, was it Star Wars Super Bombad Racing or whatever it was?
Oh, yeah.
It's certainly better than that one. And it's better than that kind of Twisted Metal ripoff.
Demolition, is it?
Yeah.
Is
that, yeah.
Terrible, yeah.
Off the top of my head, I think Demolition did make the top 200, though.
I don't know why. It's the biggest thing problem with that game, and I will rant. The biggest problem with that game is they remixed John Williams' soundtrack, and it was the worst remix I've ever heard in my life. The entire universe of Star Wars is built on this foundation of fantastic music, and they changed that, but then put Jabba the Hutt or whatever stupid character they put in some ridiculous vehicle. I just the entire game is just unbelievable.
Just, it wasn't canon, basically.
It wasn't canon, no. I'm not even a Star Wars fan that much anymore, but I mean, I just because of that. I'm thankful I never did a Star Trek game, because I probably would have hated Dreamcast because of it. Yeah, awful. I played Demolition a few weeks ago, because I had, you know, some kind of yearning for pain. And it was literally the most... I can't believe the game was released. It's so poor.
Make a note. Do not mention Demolition
to Do not ever talk about Demolition.
Yeah. I don't know where it came in Hard Drive's list of Dreamcast games, but I hope it came no higher than 246th, because if it did, that would have been a travesty.
I had actually not played Power Battles until the other week, and I had a go at it. And I was like, this is not good, but it's not terrible. Why is this scored like it has? And I went on YouTube and I checked a few different videos, and in every one of the comments there was people that got significantly younger than us that were like, oh, this was the game I played, this was the only game I had for weeks, I loved it. And I was just like, this was people's childhood who a parent got them a Dreamcast and then was like, Star Wars, I mean, you can't go wrong with Star Wars. And they got that when they were like in between 8 to 13 and they just loved it, because like, I don't think we know any better, do we, at around that age? Or if you've not played anything else, you might not realise I could be playing Dynamite Cop. So
the glorious Dynamite Cop. But that's one of the reasons why I did the book as well in the first place. Well, the first of the NES book and then all the subsequent books. And I always make sure every intro says something similar. Like I rewrite the intro in each one and have the same kind of blurb in each one where I say, look, there are loads of kind of... the 10 best Dreamcast games or the 10 best whatever lists online, and everyone can check them out, but you'll always see Soul Calibur, you'll always see Shenmue, you'll always see this. But somebody might have, like, there might be someone who had a Dreamcast and their favourite game was Ooga Booga, because that was a game that they played the most. Mm-hmm. Or someone might have got Razor Freestyle Scooter for their birthday and absolutely loved it, or their granny like gave them Snowcross Championship Racing, and so for these books are designed for people who will say, oh, what was that game I had that had the thing in it, and then so you go, oh, it was Blue Stinger. So the book, I've had a lot of people saying that they flicked through the book and discovered games they completely forgot about that were locked in their brain and they had absolutely no recollection of owning them until they saw them listed.
Yeah, I have a real experience of that with a friend of mine from my old work. He was a lapsed gamer, and he kept saying to me, "Oh, Dad, like you're like really nerdy with the games. There was this game I had where you were like in charge of a Roman city, and you had these Romans." And I kept being like, "He's called Andy." I kept naming games, and he'd be like, "Nope, nope, nope." And in the end, I just took him the SNES book in one lunchtime, got him to flick through it, and he was like, "Oh, this is it." King Arthur's Knights of Camelot or whatever it's called. It's just like Romans.
I'm gonna slightly fanboy here now as well, because I one of the great things about the Chris's Mega Drive book is I've had Mega Drive, you know, flash carts whatever for the last 15 years. I've had a massive Mega Drive collection of 200 games, but flicking through Chris's book when I got it, there was games there which I hadn't seen screenshots for since back in the sort of early 1990s, when I used to read the Mean Machines, you know, the A to Z Mean Machine books used to come out every year. I used to sit in the bingo, when my mum was playing bingo, I used to sit on a table reading these books, and it was that kind of feeling come back. So that's it's it's strange, nostalgia about video games is everywhere, isn't it? It's not only the sort of the top 10 games, it's actually things like just flicking through and seeing a screenshot you've never seen for ages. It's just, I played some games, like I played one of the Aero Fighters games, I think, for the first time. I never played it before. I just remember seeing a screenshot in Meme Machines. I think it was a very similar screenshot in the book. So, yeah, fantastic.
That's really good to hear. That's exactly what I was going for. Like, it was those, like that Complete Guide to Consoles magazine I got was like the precursor to those magazines. I had all those as well, and that's exactly the kind of the vibe I was going for. So I'm delighted to hear that.
Totally. I can never remember the name of these, but these are something you see on loads of retro gaming Twitter, and it's not called Twitter now, is it? What are we calling it? X.
I'm calling it Twitter. For SEO purposes, I'm calling it Twitter.
There we go. You see on social media sites and Instagram. It's, I think they were Virgin Interactive or Virgin Games. They were like Mega Drive and SNES tips books. Do you remember the ones? Mm-hmm. As a kid, I used to pore through them, even though I didn't have hardly any of those games, because I like looking at the screenshots for like Terminator, or I loved Jungle Strike, but didn't have Desert Strike, and I would be like reading about the missions. Your books, they remind me of that in a way, that kind of just like, this is like, I feel like I'm 9 years old in Hans Stanting again.
Exactly.
Like, looking through all these screenshots of games that I've never even seen because of where I've grown up. Like, you'd go in Menzies and they'd have like 7 Mega Drive games, and it'd be like, oh, but I want this one where you control the Roman centurions. Oh, no, we've not got that. It's like, oh, okay, I'll get this other one then.
That's awesome. That's really cool to hear. Like, it gives me a wee G up, because like I'm struggling with this year's book, because like I'm doing the Game Boy Encyclopedia this year.
Oh, nice.
Like writing it just now, and it's by far the hardest book like I've written, because it's, you would be surprised at how little information there is about a lot of these games, especially because it doesn't have a Sega Retro alternative equivalent, where someone's actually taken the effort to put manuals online and stuff like that. Like, if I would say about 60% of Game Boy manuals aren't online, and especially when a game's released on multiple formats, like if they made a SNES version and a Mega Drive version, and a NES version and a Game Boy version. Online people, all the references and resources will be about the console versions and maybe the NES one, but never the Game Boy one. And it's like, it's incredibly difficult at times to actually get information on them, which is mental, because I thought that would be really easy.
Plus I've noticed, I had the Game Boy probably about like 8 or 9, and it never dawned on me that it came in a box or that the games came in a box, because it just kind of arrived as a present. And like years ago, when my mum sold her house, I found all of those boxes. I found about half of them in the loft. Yeah. And I've noticed, like, I don't know if it's like NHL 94 or 93. If you sell the loose cart for that, it's £2. If you have the inserts and stuff, it goes up to about 70. And it's like the variance of what the card is worth compared to what the car is worth is probably the biggest of any console, because of the reason you mentioned that there's just...
Yeah, it's crazy.
So we are moving on then to our any other business. Mike, is there any burning questions you would like to get that out there? Any other games that you would like to rant about? Or
No, I'll save the ranting for my many podcast appearances in future. I suppose... For me, I've sort of a couple of questions, but sort of Dreamcast-wise, obviously you used games on ROMs on GDMU and stuff. Mm-hmm. Did you find any games that were particularly difficult to find online? I know when I've tried to find games to play and stuff, it's some games you just can't find at all.
Yeah. Some of the Japanese ones were quite tricky to find. I think from what I can remember, I think only one or two, and I don't remember off the top of my head which one or two they were, but it was one like those kind of magazine type ones, like not actual games, but kind of free ones. I ended up, it was, I'll tell you exactly what the name of it was, it's on my list. It was the other car one. It was the Alabama meets Will VI one, which is like another kind of weird car promotional disc one. And I just could not find that anywhere. So that's the only game in the book where someone had put footage of it on YouTube. And luckily, because it's like an insight, it is like a wee here's information about a car. So there's no actual playing gameplay to be had. I was able to kind of watch it on YouTube and then use YouTube as the screenshot, which I hated doing. I despised doing. But that's the only one, thankfully, that I ended up absolutely stumped on. Some of them just didn't work on GDMU. A couple of them I just couldn't boot on it. And I had to resort to emulation, which I hate doing as well, because not that I'm against emulation, like I've used emulation for years, like when I've needed to. But half of one of the points of the books is that I want to play them all on original hardware or the equivalent, as close to it as I can get, just so that when I take the screenshots, I know that's what it looked like, I want to try and make it as authentic as possible. So even though I'm using GDMU, I think the fact I'm running it on, it's still running on official hardware, lends some sort of authenticity to it. But I don't like using emulators if I can get away with it. That was about a couple of games just didn't boot and I had to switch to emulators, which was really frustrating. But 99% of them I was okay with, I would say.
No, I think that's like Mike and a few of the other guys on the team are like myself. We use a combination of emulation, GDMUs, or myself and Mike, I know we've got like a compact flash Dreamcast, which is like a hybrid, takes discs. Then I've got my original, then we've got some shell, and I'm always still using real discs because of the memory of the tactile feel of open the case, get annoyed that the case is broke, even though you've looked after it, like open the back of the case because the disc's actually in the back, put it in, turn it on. But it's
discs will always win for me. Like in terms of if it's me just deciding to play a game one night, I'll always go for the most authentic method. I will, if I've got the disc, I'll always use the disc. So I've got like my the kind of standard standard Dreamcast that I use for that. I've got my Hello Kitty one, which I occasionally use, but then I've got my GDMU one, which is
which color Hello Kitty,
the kind of greeny blue one. I can never really decide what color that is.
Yeah, they are the most glorious themed green and the pink consoles ever made.
Love it, absolutely love it. So I've got those two that I'll kind of use for discs, and then I've got my kind of GDMU one, which was it used to have a DC HDMI in it, and it was badly installed. I'll not shout out who did it because it's actually quite a reputable company and I don't want to get in trouble. But they installed it wrongly for whatever reason, and I started playing it and it started smelling really bad. So I sent it to, I can't remember his username, was it A3RGAN or whatever it is, the guy who fixes loads of consoles on Twitter, basically.
Aegon,
really, really, really nice guy. He took it and like said, yeah, it's basically frying itself as you're playing it. So he like totally replaced it and so that was nice of him.
that smell of a burning Dreamcast, I have asked that smell well. Play Blackpool, our illustrious founder decided to plug in a plug, which was the wrong, and it was an American power supply rather than a power one. And the smell of a burning Dreamcast is sailing into my brain.
Yeah, sticks with you. Sticks with you.
It does.
it must be like what crime scene investigators like to smell, like the smell never leaves you. And that was right when I was starting the book as well. And I was like, oh shit, this is... the Dreamcast is going to explode if I don't get this fixed. So it put me out of action for like a month. So that was fun and games. But it's I'll always prefer to use discs when I can. But when I'm doing a book like this and I have to fire through countless games as quickly as possible, and I need access to every single game, I'm immensely jealous of your collection because. I couldn't come close to that now. A lot of the Dreamcast games I had back in the day I sold while I was at uni, and like it would cost me an absolute fortune to get them back nowadays. Luckily most of the Dreamcast library is not massively expensive, not like the NES is or stuff like that, but there's still some like comically expensive games that it's just the market's just massively overpriced them.
Yeah, and it was like, but I think me and Mike are both lucky that we existed in the Dreamcast community where it's like, oh, I've just stood on my case for MSR. I'll just buy another brand new sealed copy on eBay for £4 with postage. Yeah. Where I think a copy of that probably runs you to about 20 at the minute, doesn't it? It's like everything is just shot up. And it's like, and a few years ago, we tried to, I tried to contact the now defunct Halifax video game store in Italy to be like, how many Dreamcast games did you order? Because there's just thousands of them still online. Unsurprisingly, Chris, no one got back to me from that communication. But you mentioned that you had the HDMI mod. What are you using now? That's a question I wanted to ask for Kinect Collections.
So now I'm using, let me get the company. I'll try and look them up, but if you know them off the top of my head, the company that does it's a SCART cable, but it's a SCART cable that does 480p.
Oh, not Pack-a-Punch.
Retro gaming cables. Yeah. So I'm using their, because they, for those who don't know, they do that. They do a SCART cable which supports 480p, so it almost acts like the VGA box, even though it's a SCART cable, and TVs won't read it. TVs won't accept a 480p SCART signal, but the RetroTINK 5X accepts it. So basically, I was running this 480p SCART cable through the RetroTINK, which was then upscaling the 480p up to 1080p. Purely just so the screenshots would be as high quality as I could possibly get while still running on original hardware, because then when they get shrunk down to book size, like they just look like really nice, crisp kind of Dreamcast screenshots. And to be honest, it looks just as good as the HDMI did. Using the 480p cable plugged into an upscaler, like it's not even an upscaler; it's a line doubler, so it doesn't do any kind of weird. Filters or anything on it. It literally just takes the lines and doubles or triples the lines, so it's like a sharp picture. It's fantastic. So I was delighted with the picture quality there.
I'm going to imagine with that natively. There's a few games that don't work VGA that are pretty good. Mm. Hydro Thunder, Mike, that's one, isn't it?
You say this. Everyone keeps saying this to me, and I've got it running on VGA, so I'm not quite sure what people are about, but yeah.
Oh, check out Mr. Big Pants here. Oh, it works on mine.
It's one of the foibles of Dreamcast, isn't it? I swear, people will say that Dreamcast, you know, some games will stop playing on this and that, and other people will get it working on that. I swear the Dreamcast is some kind of weird, possessed console sometimes.
Yeah, well, it's like I've never been able to get a download version of San Francisco Rush or Crazy Taxi 2 to work properly. They just doesn't matter where I get them from.
I can't play disc versions of V-Rally. No matter what disc version I play, retail disc version of V-Rally, it will not get past the third stage of the championship. But I can do the white label, so the promo white label disc, works absolutely fine. It's the foibles of the Dreamcast.
Crazy days.
A marvellous beast. That's it. I'm going to go back through your answer there, Chris, and then I'll put that in, because people are always asking us about connection methods. And I'm like you. I have some stuff HDMI, some stuff RGB, some stuff like every now and then phono, and people would be like, oh, my God, what are you doing? I was like, well, I had 7 minutes and this was the only cable I could find. So like, I wanted to play a game. I didn't want to be a picture snob. So, Mike, any final wrap-up questions before we move on to the close and the plug?
No, I'm good.
You are good. Right. So, Chris, can you give us the official title of the book and where people can get it?
The official title of the book is The Dreamcast Encyclopedia, : Every Game Released for the Sega Dreamcast. You can get it in all good booksellers and some of the bad ones. And if you just search for Chris Scullion, you'll find it, or if you just search for Dreamcast Encyclopedia. Alternatively, Pen and Sword Books are the official publisher of it, so they'll you can buy it from their site as well. And I believe in the US they go through a publisher called Casemate, and they also sell it. But again, it's a kind of the publisher has loads of kind of international arms and stuff, so it's out in September in the UK. It'll be out in the US and Canada around about November-ish and around Europe and stuff like that. So you should be able to get a hold of a copy if you need one. And I've got previous ones on the NES, the SNES, Mega Drive, and the N64. And then in the future, it'll be Game Boy, then PlayStation, then GameCube and Wii U in one book, then I'm starting to forget. in some random order, it's then Game Boy Advance and Xbox and PS2.
Oh, wow, amazing.
in some sort of order. And Saturn as well. Sorry, how can I forget the Saturn? Saturn's going to be one as well.
Excellent. Good luck with the PlayStation 1.
Listen, the PlayStation 1's taken 2 years. Usually each book takes me a year, but PlayStation 1's taken me 2 years because there's not a chance in hell. Nobody can do a book like that in a year. PlayStation book will take me 2 years, so that's a bit of a wait.
And what, if anyone is hearing you from the first time, they'd like to follow your day-to-day work or any of your social media, what's the best way to, or what platforms can they find you on, and what are the names of those platforms?
As long as Twitter/X still exists by the time you're listening to this, you can get me on there at Scully1888. You can find me day to day on VGC, Video Games Chronicle. That's my day job. I'm the features editor there. My blog, tiredoldhack.com, is still active, but it's just in a hibernation state at this point until I find free time to. And next year I'm going to start absolutely hammering that again with kind of weird topics, because that's where I write the weird stuff. I've got a big article planned on why 15 reasons why Princess Daisy is an arsehole. So it'd be stuff like that, basically. That's pretty much. I'm all over the place, basically. I'm a glutton for attention. So if you search for me, you'll find me somewhere, basically.
Excellent. And despite this being, I don't know, the 20th episode for this I've been on, I still don't really know any of our addresses. You will find us if you type in the Dreamcast Junkyard. You'll find our blog. We are at the DC Junkyard on X/Twitter. And I feel like in future I'm going to have to go through these episodes and add in the third name, like the Magnesium Channel or whatever he brands it to next. What are we on YouTube, Mike? Do we know this?
We're on YouTube as Dreamcast. I don't know, Kev. I mean, you're asking me these questions, mate. I barely can work my phone, mate. It's difficult enough sometimes. I'm still annoyed by Demolition, I've got to be honest with you. The mere thought of Boba Fett riding some kind of ridiculous slave Zero, I don't know. It's just the entire thing's annoyed me.
Just a message, just to the young bucks listening to this. We are all old men.
Yeah.
Like our idea of technology is the Dreamcast era. So we can get the website running, but don't expect us to be able to tell you where to find it. You're the kids. You know how to use the Google and the Yahoo and the Alta Vista and Ask Jeeves. You can find it.
Yeah. Not necessarily me or Mike's handiwork, but we got the website running on a Dreamcast, so you could connect to the site via the browser. And I believe it was also on a CDI that was pushed out, Mike.
Was it?
That's very meta. That's very meta, getting it working on a Dreamcast.
I think it might be in a podcast episode. I'm sure.
Wow.
I'm sure it was Derek has got something like that.
Wow.
That running. Just a final thing before we go, Chris. Did you see that someone had made the Cowabunga collection run, or a Cowabunga collection run on Dreamcast?
I didn't see that, but that's fantastic. That's a perfect location for it.
Yeah, the final things out. It's got loads of stuff on it. It's got episodes, like real episodes. It's one of those things. I'm always like, I'm going to download every iteration of this that he does, because this is never more than 7 minutes away from being taken down by Nickelodeon.
Especially if it's got episodes on it.
Oh yeah, it's got all sorts. It's a fantastic piece of work. I don't know why I just thought of that as we were closing this. But I would just like to thank Chris for coming on and dedicating his time. Talk about his project. It's great to hear your passion.
No, happy to come on.
So is there a concrete date for the book, or does it not work like that?
I used to think it worked like that, but apparently not. So the book has been in the warehouse for like the past couple of weeks, but apparently there's all sort of processing stuff that goes on there. It emerges that unless your book's Harry Potter or something massive, then there are no solid release days. So basically it's out when it's out. But I think they're in the process of processing it. So it'll be the start of September.
Yeah, it's not like your Dreamcast that arrives 2 weeks late.
Because I'm not sending out £20 vouchers to everyone.
Yeah, I would love that to happen with a modern console, just to see the online backlash of the people. Like, but that's probably a bit mean. Right, I would just, on behalf of myself and Mike, I'd just like to thank Chris for coming on. Hopefully you've enjoyed the show. As always, please feel free to point out the gluttony of errors that we have connected as we've gone along, especially myself. Mike, say goodbye.
Goodbye.
See, normally I say goodbye,
you would,
Mike.
You threw me.
I've gone rusty. And we're going to do that again.
Okay, even let's do it again. Cool.
Say goodbye, Mike.
Goodbye.
He's throwing me off. And thank you very much, Chris. And good luck with a book release once it comes out.
Thank you very much.
Disc on a hi-fi or other audio equipment can cause serious damage to its speakers. Please stop this disc now.